Thanks for tuning into Mountain Escapes, a podcast connecting backcountry enthusiasts like you with the stewards and caretakers of lodges throughout British Columbia, Canada. Each episode highlights one of British Columbia's unique backcountry lodges through a conversation with the lodge owner and/or operator. Your host, Brad Harrison, has worked and adventured in remote settings his entire life. He's owned and operated lodges, guided guests and colleagues, provided avalanche skills training, and is the executive director of the Backcountry Lodges of British Columbia Association. Here he is.
Hey there, welcome to Mountain Escapes. I'm Brad Harrison. Today I'm talking with a father and son team who run a lodge and adventure tourism operation in the Coast Mountain Range. They love to ski, hike, and host guests year-round, and I'm looking forward to learning more from them. Guys, please tell us about yourselves.
I'm Ron Andrews, and my son and I, Lars, own and operate Whitecap Alpine Adventures in north of Pemberton in the Coast Chilcotin Mountains. The lodge was a pre-existing building when I got first introduced to the area and was skiing in the area. So that started for me back in 1978 when I first skied in the area and found this lodge. And so Lars was skiing there not long after, when he was about 6 years old, when he first went up there. As far as it being a backcountry lodge operation, we started this together back in 2000, mainly at that time only. At that time, it was a winter operation. So that was our beginnings there. What do you got something to add to
that? I guess the operation's unique because it's, I essentially grew up skiing there, learned how to ski there, and then translated that experience into becoming a mountain guide, which wasn't necessarily directly involved with the lodge operation. You know, between 98 and 2000, we realized there was, you know, something there. I mean, people had rented it and skied out of there for years, Alpine Club of Canada, other guides and things like that. But ultimately, the opportunity was there. I didn't really see clearly what the vision was at that point because I didn't have a good sense of what the place could really offer outside the fact that I skied there my entire life, but I'd never seen it through the eyes of a guided operation. And so it was really the influence of Ron, my dad, and other guides that had gone to the lodge rented it, to really get me to see what the potential was of the area. In truth, the industry was not well formed. I mean, Brad can probably speak to this as well, is that there were pockets of ski touring operations like Golden Alpine and Selkirk Mountain Experience. In those places, they had there, but it wasn't widespread. It wasn't what it is now, obviously. And that wave hadn't really started yet. There's lots of, you know, it was still fringy or fringe-like. And then from that point on, it started to gain traction. And so it was easier to kind of create the traction for the business out of that kind of movement from 2005 to 2010, really. But yeah, and so through my eyes, I just saw the place as it was where I grew up skiing. So I didn't see the potential. I just thought it was a place that my parents took me to punish me for not going to the ski hill.
That's an excellent summary, Lars. I love that. So, yeah, thanks for sort of laying the groundwork for your operation. And we're going to talk a little bit later more about the lodge. Right now, I just want to talk a little bit about you and you guys, how you started the lodge. You know, you've gone through some of it already, but a little more of it. And, you know, I just want to, Ron, if you can tell us a little bit more about the early history of the lodge, because I know there's some stories to be told about that.
Well, yeah, the lodge was originally built and put into usable operation in 1972. So it was the year that Lars was born, actually. I didn't know the people at all. I hadn't been in the area. But, you know, I had done a lot of ski touring in various parts of BC and Alberta earlier on, and was looking for a place to go skiing, 1978, with a group of friends. And so we hired a helicopter, flew in there, and lo and behold, the lodge had been rented out to a group of alpine clubbers. We hadn't planned on being at the lodge. We didn't know anything about it. We were just camping in the snow. Anyway, push comes shove, we got to introduced to the people that owned the lodge, and I thought it was kind of a cool spot, and sold myself as being a reasonable sort of person that could rent the building and use it. So they saw that as a good idea as well, and so I started renting the lodge and using it to take my family up first, as Lars has said, and then other friends of mine. So that's, you know, how I became associated with the lodge at McGilvery Pass. Previous to the lodge being in McGilvery Pass, the area was used in the 1890s by miners, and they followed Indigenous people's paths up into the pass because the Indigenous people used that pass to traverse in the area. So that's the history of the pass being there, and the fact that it was a known place, it was traversed and so on. It had a reputation for killing people because there were lots of avalanches happened, and the original people who had wanted to build the lodge before they got a chance to do that were both killed in an avalanche very close to where the lodge is situated today. So there was a long history of back and forth as the property kind of changed hands and became what it is now. It was a private company that owns McGilvery Lodge. And then, as Lars said, he got going with his operation using the lodge to create Whitecap Alpine. So,
correct me if I'm wrong, but I understand that you're, unlike almost, I think, every other backcountry lodge that I know of, you actually sit on private property where your lodge is that correct?
Yeah, that's correct. It's 40 acres of like homestead. Fee simple.
That's unique, I think, in the whole, all lodges I know, in any case. So you started out and you kind of laid the groundwork for us how this began. So can you give us, we'll let both of you have a run at this. Can you give us a bit of a sense on who's the boss and your day-to-day operation?
It's a good question. Who's the boss, Ron?
Well, definitely not me. I mean, I'm the caretaker. I do all the fiddly little things that I think are needed to create creature comforts. Some of them are pretty hokey, invented by me, and gradually we've made all these systems work and improved on them as time goes by. But Lars actually is in charge of how Whitecap runs in a very big way. So, and I'm quite happy to have that situation. I mean, I don't want to make those decisions and so on. Lars has got the chops for doing that.
I think when we first started, there was definitely some tension on what direction we were going to go. Ron was very much a grassroots, self-guided type of keep it rustic and keep it, close to the earth type of vision. And mine was a bit different. And I think there was some tension when we first started with that. My role was taking it to the public and turning it into a more robust commercial operation. So that just involved a bit of vision in terms of how the area could be used and guided and how the experience at the lodge would be communicated and then executed on. So for me, it was the vision of it was a bit more of a modern take on ski touring experiences I would have when I was a kid. And that's essentially what it's translated into. I mean, it's a great place to go skiing. There's great skiing close by the lodge. There's incredible ski mountaineering opportunities near there. And all of those were kind of what we turned into the operation. But yeah, so ultimately, you know, Ron's the boss of the lodge and I'm the boss of the operation. So that's how it breaks down.
And so Ron, it must, you know, I'm going to take a bit of a winger here, but it must be proud to have your son you know, following up with your vision.
Yeah, I'm definitely proud of that. But what I want to make really clear, though, is that, like, when I first got started the lodge, I Lars wasn't even finished grade school yet, and I had no intention that my son should become a guide or like the mountains or anything else. I mean, the fact that Lars, you know, went ahead and became a full mountain guide and has guided all over the world. And yeah, that makes me proud, proud that he's taken this operation and made it work as well as it has. So yeah, I'm proud of that. But I had no intention that he necessarily become a guide. That was his decision.
Yeah.
Maybe we'll move on.
Yeah. I made the decision, but there was definitely some shaping of those decisions along the way. Let's put it that way.
Well stated, Lars.
Yeah.
I'm picking up what you're putting down.
Yeah.
This episode of Mountain Escapes is brought to you by Talus Backcountry Lodge. Talus is a back-to-the-basic wilderness lodge specializing in
epic backyard adventures. Yodeling!
Join us in the summer for some yodel-inducing hiking, or in the winter for some whoop-worthy backcountry skiing. In any season, finish your day in the lodge enjoying some mountain comfort food and discover why Talus is a true journey for the soul. Access Talus through Canmore, Alberta. Learn more at taluslodge.com. Talus Backcountry Lodge is a proud member of the Backcountry Lodges of British Columbia Association.
Okay, we're going to, we're here with Lars and Ron Andrews, and we've been talking a little bit about them. We're going to move on to the lodge. I'm just curious, you said, I think you started originally with a winter operation, or is that the same now, or do you see more winter business, more summer business?
The summer business has been there for a while, but not to any great degree. We haven't done a lot of marketing or a lot of outside communications about what the summer is like there. I mean, we knew that the summer there is spectacular. It's just a matter of how we're creating the market for that and where we're drawing from it. So the summer's not quite nearly as big as the winter. I'd say it's probably by the end of this year should be equal to about a quarter of what the winter does in terms of volume. The winter, you know, runs pretty much solidly from the second week of December through the middle of April. That's kind of our winter season. Summer is really second week of July through Canadian Thanksgiving, first week of October. And that's really our window for that. I do feel like that the growth for us in terms of the lodge and operation is in the summer. And that's where we're spending a lot of resources and putting the right people in place to kind of help run and shape the what that looks like and how that's communicated to the public.
And do you find that your typical summer customer the same person as your typical winter customer? Are the demographics the same?
That's a good question, and it's turning out that the summer demographic is very similar to the winter demographic. It's how those demographics are shaped, and it's a broader demographic. So you have an ability to bring multi-generational families in. So the 5-year-olds can enjoy it, and the 85-year-olds can enjoy it. So I think that's a little bit different, and we do see that, but we do see the core demographic as being really a 35 to 65-year-old active person that's looking for some sort of connection to an interesting place and an interesting place to stay. So I think that's what we're drawing on. There is a really strong push from the kind of trail running and scrambling demographic as well, which is kind of a higher end athlete, which kind of aligns a little bit with the winter. And really that's it for now. we have been seeing younger people be very interested in. So let's talk about the 20 to 35 year olds. And we do see some groups coming up in that age group, but boils down to price for a lot of them. So that becomes challenging.
And so, you know, traditionally, activities are hiking, climbing. Those are traditional summer activities. So you mentioned trail running. Have you branched out into any other, I'll call it non-traditional summer activities, i.e. supping, bird watching, artistic groups, mountain biking? Mountain biking is obviously a very fast growing segment.
Yeah. I mean, my direct peer group are all in the mountain bike industry, and there's been lots of questions and pressure from that group for me to, you know, do something like that. I don't have any interest in mountain biking in that area. I think the trail development would be prohibitive. And it's a very difficult thing to see how it would work with the lodge in the valley. It would be just too difficult. There's not enough. It's too steep, the terrain, and the trail development would be too, you know, just be really difficult. Bird watching, yes, we've had bird watching groups there that are, you know, very keen on that, the valley, because of its situation in the Coast Range. Not supping. Yeah, people can, you know, there's lakes around people can sup on. We haven't really jumped in there. There's nowhere to go, really. So it becomes just more of a something to do after a hike or a run or a scramble. We are seeing lots of bookings, very robust bookings from the trail running and scrambling crew, like people that want to do ridge running and linking up third class peaks and things, and which fortunately for us, the lodge has really an endless supply of, and do, you know, big loops and interesting, not quite mountaineering, but not quite on trail stuff. So lots of third and fourth class scrambling, which is incredible there.
A comment, Brad, Lars, about the bird watching. The wildlife, you know, the chance of encountering wildlife such as the megafauna, grizzly bears and the big game moose and deer and so on is pretty good. Just by being quiet and observant, you can see things. As of 4 days ago at 7:30 in the morning, I had a visit from two black wolves right in the front yard of the lodge. So for me, that's always been a really exciting thing, getting to see the game. It's hard to wake people up sometimes to get them to see things like that just out the window. But if you're wandering through the countryside, there's wide vistas or views, and it's not uncommon for people to encounter and see the megafauna, which is really pretty exciting for a lot of people.
So just curious, both of you have kind of spent multiple years in this industry. I just want to hear just a quick summary from each one of you just on, you know, the remarkable changes, if there are any remarkable changes that you've seen in the last, say, since you started 2020 years. In 20 years, have you seen change in this adventure tourism industry, specifically the lodge business?
Well, I've seen people go from what I would call a granola crowd, you know, with the wool knickers and wool socks and Telemark skis, to really using real skis and modern equipment to travel around the mountains. And so there's just been a large surge of interest from all kinds of people to be in the backcountry skiing, ski touring, and what that can offer. So that in the last 20 years has become, in my way of thinking, it's doubled, tripled, and quadrupled in interest from the public. So it's definitely been an area where more and more people are learning to enjoy the backcountry.
Yeah, I'd concur with that. I think there's that wave is coming from a whole variety of different sources. One is the interest in activity and experience and the value in that. And I think people are understanding that when wealth is in the experiences that you can afford to take rather than the material things that you can afford to buy. And I think that that's, you know, fundamental to the fact that this has created this wave of interest in activities and pursuits and experiences that are similar to this. And in the ski realm, I think it's just really become the primary core group of skiers. It's not, ski hills are not where you see the core skiers anymore. You see it at the backcountry parking lots, and you see it at lodges and operations like this, and off doing their own thing. And then it's just the availability of the information about that stuff. It's so easy to see people out there skiing in pow and jumping off cliffs and skiing pillows. And I mean, social media has been a part of the last kind of 8 years of wave. But prior to that, it was word of mouth or magazines or, you know, or serving the internet and stuff like that. So the availability of that information is much more readily there. And so I think that's driven a lot of it.
So you both spoke about the visitor side and how that's changed. How do you see the industry, you know, specifically the lodge owners, have they changed in the last 20, 25 years?
Well, there's some old dudes still hanging around. I know that. But I think the expectations of the lodge experience is heightened. So, you know, what it is to stay at a lodge. I mean, I think we still are fitting in the rustic world of, you know, people still taking a crap in the outhouse. But we have internet, showers, heat, private rooms, you know, high-end meals, like all that kind of stuff. And so I think the owners, there's a few of us now that are second generation, you know, lodge owners, runners, you know, there's at least four in the industry now that are inheriting the lodges from their families or their whoever started them, their dads or moms or whatever. So I think that's just a new take on stuff. It's just an evolved take on things. It's like anything. It's just the product gets more and more refined until it reaches its kind of pinnacle. And I don't think it's quite there yet.
And if I was to ask you, you know, what, looking down the road a few years or many years, what do you want Whitecap to have done to the world? What's your vision for Whitecap Alpine Adventures?
Well, I think it's more of a question of whether the culture that we create and the experience that we create at the lodge is able to be carried on. And the way that my vision and idea of how to utilize the landscape carries on. I mean, my interest in doing this stuff was to give people an experience they wouldn't normally have otherwise. And if that is still the culture of the lodge and the experiences at the lodge, then I'll be happy with it. Ultimately, I'm going to turn into Ron. I'm going to be the old dude splitting wood at the in the back of the lodge, hopefully keeping it running. And, you know, there's going to be some physical changes there. And that's just a necessity of keeping that place alive. But ultimately, it'll be the same, hopefully, for another 50 years, if it still snows.
Yeah, unfortunately, you're not the first person to mention the future of snow. But just to wrap up here, both of you have so many years of experience and a wealth of information in the backcountry, and we're very thankful for you sharing that with us. Before we go, I'd love to hear a memory or story from each of you. Something to do with the lodge, exploring the backcountry. It can be funny, scary, remarkable, whatever. Are you comfortable sharing one of your favorite stories with us?
I don't know if it's my favorite story of all time or even the most remarkable, but it's one of the ones that stands out the most to me. It was the first time that Ron let me go up to the lodge on my own and run it on my own with a group of friends. And, you know, there was obviously some negotiation on my part to get up there. And and bring the group of skiers that I thought would be appropriate to go in. Most of the people had very little or no backcountry skiing experience. And the equipment was obviously horrible, but it was coordinated and arranged and things like that. And so got to go up there, and I can't remember how old I was, but I was still in my teens. And we, you know, we flew in and set up, and like Ron gave me the keys, and we opened up. And the thing that stands out to me the most was the fact that, you know, we had an evening call with my parents every night to check in. And so the evening call, of course, was not on a sat phone, because there wasn't such a thing. And there might have been at that point, but we didn't have access to it. Not on the internet or any of that stuff. It was on the single sideband. So we would have to get the single sideband set up in the evening. And I'm sure my parents, I mean, I don't know what they were thinking, but I'm sure they were, my mom was probably terrified that something was happening to us. Ron probably didn't give a shit, but that's, you know, we know, and I had the full confidence that I could avoid getting in any avalanches or anything like that. And so every evening we'd all kind of gather around in the kitchen area where the single sideband is, and you'd have to dial this thing up, and you have to connect to a BCTEL operator on the single sideband, and then they would dial you through to my folks, and then you talk on a radio mic, so you'd have to key it to talk and let it go, and you'd hear what they have to say, and then they were on the phone on the other side. So for me, that's kind of the most standout kind of story from the lodge, because one, it proved my dad trusted me. Two, I proved I didn't mess it up by blowing up the place or killing anybody, and that still is not yet to be determined. And then from there, it was kind of like, it was this, it became my experience more than just a family experience at that point. And that to me made a huge difference to how I experienced the place. But yeah, like when I tell people about talking on the single sideband, most people don't even have any idea what that's about. And so, yeah, there's my story.
Thanks, Lars.
As interesting, you mentioned that single
sideband. You remember that, don't you, Ron?
I do. It was really funny because today I had a story to tell at Ian's memorial about that same single sideband. And we were doing the same thing. We, you know, four of my friends, we were up there skiing. And Ian, he got quite sick. He got a really bad cold. He didn't let anybody sort of, you know, take care of him. He just was sort of toughing it through with his bad cold. And the next day, at the end of the trip, we were to ski 15 or 20 kilometers out to the road. So we weren't able to do that because of Ian's sickness, although we tried. And a storm came in, so we went back to the lodge. And we had to use that same single sideband to call in to Ian's wife. And it was hilarious, funny. We're all standing in the area, like Lars says, by the kitchen, by the phone. Everybody can hear everything. And we get through to Ian's wife, and he starts to tell her this tale of woe, feeling really sick, and there's a bad storm, and we're not going to be able to ski out. And Ian's wife's response was hilarious. She was a hockey fan, and the first thing she said was, "Marcus Naslin broke his leg." And that was the only... That's our only response. It was over the single sideband. So we could hear everything that was going on. Everybody was part of the conversation. It was pretty funny. But funny you should mention that, Lars, because I was telling that story today.
Great stories, you guys. Thanks to both of you for sharing your backcountry experiences and expertise from Whitecap Alpine Adventures. We wish you all the best and hope to talk to you in the very near future.
Thanks, guys. Appreciate it.
Okay.
You've reached the voicemail for the Mountain Escapes podcast, My Best Backcountry Story. We're thrilled you called, and we're sorry to have missed you, but we're out making our own moments in the backcountry. Go ahead and tell us your soul-filling, heart-singing, stomach-dropping, mind-blowing, bestest backcountry story, and we'll throw it up on the pod. Thanks again, and keep them stories coming.
This story is from Alex, a guide at Assiniboine Lodge.
So this is a wildlife viewing story at Assiniboine. And so I had 11 women that were, they're all friends from their book clubs and various clubs. And so one of the ladies in the morning, she says, well, the plan for the day is we're going up Mount Cotley. And one of the ladies approaches me in the morning. She says, Alex, I would love to see some wildlife. And I said, well, I'll do my best. We'll just go hiking. And so we leave the lodge, and 15 minutes into the hike in one of these meadows, come across a doe, and she's just sitting there. So all the cameras come out and all the ladies are happy, and we keep going. And then we make our way up. So now we're gaining the ridge of Cotley, and then I see a big fat marmot. He's suntanning, and so we keep going, and then we see three mountain goats, and then we get up to the top, and then go down the nice scree slope. I don't know if some of you have hiked there, and we get down to the meadows, and one of the ladies comes up to me, and she says, oh, I would love to see a grizzly. I said, well, I have to explain to her how special this day is already. And sure enough, 20 minutes later, we see a grizzly. So we keep going down to the meadows, and I'm just thinking, well, how do I finish this day? And I think, oh, I'll just take them the back trail and drop them all off at their cabins. So we turn the corner, where we pass the Nasit huts, and down below, there's that stream that goes below the Nasit huts. And so I turn the corner, and all my ladies are behind me, and I turn the corner, and there's this woman standing like next to the trail, next to the creek, and she's naked, and she's peeing, and she puts out her hand, and she says, stop! And so I turn, and all my ladies turn. And now we're facing downstream, and there's 10 naked women below us. And so it's like, oh, all right. So we keep going, go past this naked, this one that's peeing, and we go past to the huts. And I drop them all off at their huts. And one of the ladies, she thanks me for the day. And she's, oh my goodness, the wildlife today, and the mountain women.
Thanks again for listening to this episode of Mountain Escapes, a backcountry podcast. I hope you enjoyed hearing from Ron and Lars of Whitecap Alpine, operating out of McGilvery Pass Lodge. I'll be back soon with another episode sharing some stories and knowledge of backcountry adventures in British Columbia. This podcast is funded in part by members of the BLBCA and hosted by me, Brad Harrison.